We have never agreed for our lands to be invaded or occupied. We have never consented to it, and we will never ever surrender or compromise. We occupied government buildings, we blockaded highways, and we talked about not just marching, but direct action to shut this shit down. That's the only thing that they're going to understand is when we actually take action to shut them down.
Welcome to Indigenous Action, where we dig deep into critical issues impacting our communities throughout occupied America, or what we call Turtle Island.
This is an autonomous anti-colonial broadcast with unapologetic and claws-out analysis towards total liberation.
So take your seat by this fire, and may the bridges we burn together light our way.
Yate, this is Klee. And I am one of your hosts today, coming at you from occupied Flagstaff, or what we call Kinflana, at the base of the holy San Francisco Peaks.
Oka, hello everybody. My name is Bon, and I am also in occupied Flagstaff. It's so great to be here today as one of your hosts.
Maltioch, Sio Osiju, this is Kinbalam, or Anthony Choice Diaz, and I'm getting back to you all from the heart of Silicon Valley, occupied Ohlone territory.
All right. Well, I just want to welcome our listeners to our conversation today. We have some extremely influential, inspiring, and powerful guests today. We're going to talk today about our experiences in different movement spaces across, for some of us, decades of organizing, and we're going to look at some of the social conditions that have impacted how we've been able to move successfully and sometimes not so successfully. So we'll dig into that a little bit today, and then also our guests will talk to you about some of the things that they're doing right now and ways that you could feel called to move and contribute to our struggles and the resistance.
For those of you who've been waiting for another show to put the action back into Indigenous Action, this is that show. You're going to hear the collective history, if you will, or experience from a bunch of, well, troublemakers that spans probably over at least 60 years or more between all of us together. And you'll get to hear it from multiple trajectories, multiple coasts, across multiple imaginary borders.
We would like to start with the introduction from Kanahus. If you could introduce yourself for our listeners and maybe provide some updates on the struggles that you're facing in your lands.
Waikikaitip, Kanahus Bethke, Manuel Risquest here from Suquamuk Uluk, the unceded, unsurrendered territory of the Suquamuk in so-called British Columbia, Canada. Right now I'm calling from Tiny House Warriors, which is in Blue River, unceded territory here, and we're stopping at Thousand Man, Trans Mountain Man Camp. We're just millimeters outside of a colonial injunction that has been put in place to protect this Trans Mountain pipeline. We're within a group of women warriors that really were inspired to stand up and take back land, to defend land by building homes to place in the path of this construction of this pipeline. And now here, 2020, we're seeing the construction amping up. We're going to continue to see more actions taking place, but this is not the only spot. There's a bunch of different hot spots across this whole province and so-called country of Canada, where Native people are standing back under a collective, banner of land, and we're fighting for our land in defense of our land and our rights to our land, and including our waters. But most importantly right now, I want to say that here we have young women, and it's young women that are being inspired to stand on the front lines, and we need our men to stand with us, and we need our uncles and our brothers and to come and stand with Native women on the front lines. Like right now, we are getting firewood for the winter, and it's just all of us women here, and we need our men to stand with us. So that's my message today, is that we know the importance of our men within our warrior societies. And, you know, we're calling on them to stand and start taking land back everywhere with us.
My name is Gord Hill from the Kwakwaka'wakw. Right now at this present time, there's blockades and resistance going on at Six Nations because they're trying to stop the construction of some kind of condominium project or something. And that's been going on for a little while now. And they've been really pushing the land back hashtag. That's kind of like one of their main slogan, land back. So that's going on right now. They've put a bus on one of the roadways and they dug up another roadway and been facing off with the Ontario Provincial Police. And then the other main thing going on right now is in the Mi'kmaq territory on the East Coast, where they've been one of the Mi'kmaq bands has been trying to do a moderate livelihood fishery, a lobster fishery. They've been waiting for years, I think even like two decades or something, for the government to implement the Supreme Court decision that would have enabled them to carry out this type of fishery. So they went ahead and they've been carrying it out, and they faced pretty large opposition from the predominantly white settler fishermen out there who've been, I don't know if you've seen, there's been a lot of mob violence with these predominantly white mobs showing up, trying to stop them from doing a lobster fishery, and then showing up at these warehouses that buy the lobsters, and they burned down one of the lobster warehouses, and they burned down some of the vehicles of the Mi'kmaq fishers. So that's two of the main things going on right now, along with the Trans Mountain Pipeline opposition that Canhoos is involved in. I think that's some of the main things going on right now. Yeah. In my territory, people are mostly organizing against fish farms.
I know you have a lot of experience writing about and organizing over the years in relation to the historical uprisings and what's happening today. What do you see as like the sort of connection or connecting points with the sort of younger generations, if you will?
Well, I think one thing with Indigenous resistance, especially in Canada, it just kind of goes on. And it has its own kind of movement that's, in a lot of ways, it's not really attached or influenced to a great degree by other social movements. I mean, I think of like OCA in 1990, you had the collapse of the East Bloc, and a lot of leftist movements were in decline. There was a lot of demoralization at the time, but that didn't really affect the Mohawks. Like, they had their own land struggle going on. And I think that it's the same thing today, even though we've seen these big uprisings against police brutality, police murder in the United States, the Black Lives Matter. You've had this huge, like, insurgent movement arise. And in Canada, the Mi'kmaq, you know, they're doing their thing. It's not really connected to Black Lives Matter or any other social movements. Like, they're engaged in this fight for a livelihood, which is part of their traditional livelihood. And then Six Nations, like, always has something going on there. It is like a continuation, but it seems like it's within the Indigenous communities that are affected, and they regenerate themselves. So you have a lot of young people being involved in these struggles, but they're very localized. I mean, they're probably inspired to some degree by seeing these big rebellions going on in the United States and in other parts of the world, but it's just kind of like, I've always found Indigenous struggles to be really locally based and not always influenced by other movements. But, you know, it does happen, but that's kind of my sense of what's going on.
Yeah, we're going to bring in Inamiki, who is a deep thinker, analyst, as well as provocateur.
Hi, well, this is Inamiki Kashikna. I'm of the Menominee Nation of Wisconsin. I grew up in the West Indies, however, and I currently live in Canada, so I try and bring all those different perspectives to what I do. I'm currently located in, let's just call it, southern or southwestern Ontario. I think both Canhoos and Gord have already said some of the major points about like kind of the big sort of news catching struggles that have been going on in this country. So I'll just mention a couple of the sort of local ones or regional ones. As Gord was just saying, a lot of our movements tend to be more regional or more local. So of course, where I am is only about 45 minutes away from Caledonia, from Six Nations, where the 1492 land back lane struggle is happening right now. But we also have a lot of struggles against pipeline issues in this region as well. There's something called the Line 9 pipeline. It's an older pipeline, but they've been wanting to reverse the flow of it to take tar sands bitumen from like Sarnia, Ontario area, which is right on the Ontario-Michigan border, and send it up to, I think, Montreal to go out the St. Lawrence. So there's been a lot of resistance around that, particularly being led closer to my area by the Chippewas of the Thames First Nation. And then all the way down at the source point in Sarnia, there's a couple of First Nations communities down there, like Walpole Island, and Amjinog First Nation in particular, which are both Anishinaabe communities. Amjinog in particular is sort of like right smack in the center of what they sometimes call the Chemical Valley in this country. You go down there, and I've been down there many times for actions and for gatherings. It's really stark. You have a First Nations community that's just basically surrounded on all sides by like oil refineries, plastic plants, all sorts of chemical plants, and it's really affected people's livelihoods. Not just their livelihoods, but their lives themselves. You know, people almost everyone's born with asthma, all sorts of stuff, and so there's also consequently been a lot of direct action that goes on down there. When I Will Know More happened, there was a railway blockades. More recently, some useful women, sister activist warriors have were ultimately released by the colonial courts of attaching themselves to a pipeline valve. So that's sort of what a lot of the struggles in this area are focusing around. So you have things like the land back issue around Caledonia, but then a lot of it, like it is out west, like it is on the prairies and the plains, kind of focused on these sort of pipeline kind of issues.
So you brought up Idle No More, and there was a critique of Idle No More. I think, Gord, you had written about this too as well, and how there was this sort of flash mob style round dances that were happening. It galvanized a lot of support, and it was, you know, sort of like that new wave trend of this sort of hashtag activism that we see. And we see that now to some degree with Land Back, but it seems to be a different emergent struggle. Perhaps Kanahus, we can bring that back to you to talk about that. You know, what is direct action look like in this political environment in terms of, you know, this idea of Land Back? Because I think you've been doing Land Back before it was a hashtag. and then bring in some of your analysis regarding that. Gord, I'd really be interested in hearing about that.
Yeah, I have a lot to say about that, and I have a lot to say about just the mass organization, organizing that came out and sparked out of Idle No More. I was just, at the time of Idle No More, I was already, had been through serving jail time for land defense and for land back work at Sun Peaks, Squaw Quilt. We're fighting a massive ski resort development that ended up going through, and we're still fighting that expansion today. Which was in 2001, 2002. And so I ended up moving and living in an underground pit house. And I lived in an underground pit house for like 3 winters. And I went straight back into actually showing that I could live off the land, proving that I can live in a traditional home with dirt floor and fire and only cook over the fire and just live back in the ways the elders were saying, you got to just live it. You can't just talk about it. You got to live it. And then so Idle No More came and people walked up to the pit house and they're like, hey, the natives are fighting back and Idle No More. And I was like, Idle No More? Like, what the fuck is that? Idle No More? Like, fuck, we've never been idle and stuff. And this is a fucked up thing. Like, what's going on with the native people? I just go into a pit house for 3 years and now next thing you know, people are doing this. But then native people were coming out and the type of Native people that we never saw come out before. You know, like these are mainstream Native people. Some of them are even sellout Natives, and they all just start coming out for whatever issues where they were facing in their region of the country. And we start to see how people were using social media to say, let's just put an event out. And then next thing you know, Natives are there. And people, some of these people in these cities weren't even ever organizers to, before. They just said, all I did was put out a Facebook event page. And next thing you know, there's 1,000 Natives there. And we're round dancing. And it was like organically what happened when they put a Facebook event page. So you could just look at a case study of how that was. But it had to be the change of the time. The Mayan calendar was saying, they were saying it was coming to the end of the Mayan calendar. But it was the new Baktum, the new energy that was happening in that time. This lady, I don't know, Gora probably remembers her name, had a fast, and that fast and that brought a lot of attention, the spiritual, cultural fast that this lady was doing. And they were fighting, I believe, like some type of big diamond mine, De Beers or something like that. Gora probably knows more details and facts about it. But the fact that that happened, and we witnessed that. And as organizers who were really hard to organize, just getting 20 people together to do an action, just getting bad people, then next thing you know, you see all these people coming out for Native issues. But what's their commitment level and how far are they willing to go, you know? I have my bail, the bail pig calling me right now because I'm out on bail for a Trans Mountain Pipeline. She called twice and I keep on declining her call. So I'm going to have to remember to call her back after this, but don't want warrants out on November 1st. But this is the reality of what we have to deal with. And to really just look at the organizing as a case study of how did Idle No More spark off with getting and able to mobilize so much Native people that we've been trying to get out for all of that time. And then seeing land back and not wanting to be a hashtag. We don't want to be a hashtag Black Lives Matter hashtag. We don't want that. We don't want land back to be a hashtag. We want land back to be fucking engraved in your fucking flesh so you know who you are. You are land back. That's the only reason why you are born on this earth as Native people right now. The small little percentage of Indigenous land defenders that are on this planet, you have a big job to do. And we need all those people that came out during Idle No More and all those people that are showing Indigenous solidarity for the Wet'suwet'en and all those thousands and tens of thousands of people to really put their bodies and their money behind what they're saying. If they support and land back, then that means money. That means skill set. That means you're a lawyer, you're putting 10 hours a week in. You're an economist, you're doing analysis of why land back is so threatening to their system and convincing investors to pull out. You're doing everything you can in your skill set. Donate your hours to land back for real. And I think that for me, I just made this is my life. And so I'm here sitting in a tiny house and actually moved all the canning that was freezing outside back into tiny houses. So that's sort of like my reality right now where I am not doing frontline camp stuff. But that's my role. But I want to see big picture and I want to see how are we going to elevate Native people and our resistance to the next level without getting our people thrown in jail and killed.
Here in so-called Arizona, we started diagnosing this, what we called the Idle No More effect during that trend, because there were a lot of folks showing up and it was really great. They'd show up at malls, disrupt with a round dance, and they'd go shopping right afterwards. And a lot of longtime organizers would show up and they would actually be excluded purposefully because they were quote unquote too radical. And so that was a dynamic that we wanted to make sure that we avoided and organized to address to ensure that we had a better understanding of diversity of tactics and actually talk about the strategies. Like, what do we mean by this Idle No More? Just like you said, our people have never been idle. And I really liked what you said about you are land back. And I'm really curious as to what your thoughts are regarding that, Gord.
Well, with the Idle No More, it's going to... I mean, my understanding of the Idle No More was it was basically started by these petty bourgeois organizers who are middle class professionals. And so that really informed their politics and how they approached the entire struggle. And it started as a protest against some bills that the federal government was going to pass that was going to affect different waterways. And so that was how the protest started. But I think along with the social media thing, I think a big part of it was it was really hyped by the corporate media. And then you had the fast outside Parliament Hill in Ottawa. And there was kind of like this big media hype around it. And I think that's what really pushed it and made the hashtag, you know, really something. And that's what really started getting people mobilized. So, and it had like positive and negative things. I mean, the negative things were, it was very, very pacifist. You know, they really imposed this nonviolent civil disobedience. Well, they didn't even do that. They weren't even about civil disobedience. Anytime there was proposals for a direct action, the Idle No More leadership basically squashed it because they're very, you know, they're very tied in with a lot of the Indian Act band council chiefs who are they're involved in the oil and gas industry. So you had this whole indigenous petty bourgeois movement arise. And at the same time, it was really timely and it inspired a lot of indigenous people who were never involved. They never came to rallies like Canhoose was talking about. So it really mobilized thousands of indigenous people. But at the same time, it was trying to impose this really pacifist, basically non-action type of movement. And so that was problematic. But thankfully, at the same time, we had Elsie Pugtug arise. And Elsie Pugtug was a Mi'kmaq struggle against fracking, and they're trying to protect their land and water, exactly what Idle No More was talking about. And where was Idle No More? They're nowhere. Mi'kmaq warriors are standing there fighting against the police and against these companies coming in, and Idle No More stands down. So that was pretty revealing. And I think Elsie Pugtug showed what a militant, indigenous, grassroots resistance movement looks like, and it was victorious. And that's something I think a lot of people forget about when they talk about Elsie Pugtug, or if they even talk about it at all. And then after that, we had the Dakota Access Pipeline struggle, which was, again, this huge hyped up movement. There's 20,000 people there, and they were not victorious. But I would refer people to look at Elsie Pugtug as an example of how a community can successfully resist, you know, the oil and gas industry. But I mean, Idle No More, you know, it was a historical movement. It was important and it contributed a lot. And I'm glad that it's over.
So we faced a lot of that co-optation here as well. I mean, I think, you know, referencing Standing Rock, and I know you could talk a lot about this as well, kind of who's, but one of the things that we address is that we have to own the failures at Standing Rock. We can't count that as a success except for the cultural movement, the social movement that was really undeniable. But strategically, tactically, and if we're looking at, you know, shutting down a pipeline, intervening in resource colonialism, we have to accept that failure, study it, learn from it, and figure out how we can be more effective. And so I guess the question for you is, how do we make sure, or what would you recommend that we make sure that, or to do, what actions could we take so land back doesn't become co-opted as well, or defused and turned into this sort of liberal pacifying tool?
Oh, well, I think one thing is, I mean, land back seems a little more organic. It's not a group. It's not like trying to present itself as a movement with a leadership. So I think right there, it's going to be much more autonomous, and it's going to be hard for someone to come in and say, well, land back should actually be this. It should actually be really pacifist and nonviolent. And I think with the Six Nations, they're promoting the land back. You already have a militant resistance. You already have the diversity of tactics being used there. So I think it's already been established that this isn't going to be Idle No More, and there is no leadership to try to co-opt it. So I think it's already a different type of movement already. Yeah.
Well, unfortunately, it looks a little different here in the so-called U.S. because we have an organization that calls themselves a collective. They're not a collective. They have an executive director and a massive budget called the Indian Collective, and they have the .org, landback.org. So we have that sort of dynamic that is emerging, and something that hopefully there will be some challenge and pushback and critique regarding as well.
wonder what their view is of the Six Nations land back resistance going on right now then.
Yeah, that's an important question, one that we should be a discussion that we should be having to inform, to make sure we don't have those kind of like liberal co-optations or nonprofit domination of these struggles. So I want to bring that back to you, Inamiki.
Right. Well, I think I just would want to echo some of the points that have already been made. I mean, I missed I Don't Know More. I lived in Canada from 2005 to 2011, and then I moved back here in 2014. So I actually followed Gord's analysis a lot of I Don't Know More, and it was really informative for myself about how, you know, it kind of grew out of this sort of petty bourgeois sort of, I think they were academics and lawyers sort of leadership. But I think at the same time, there was kind of this sort of important moment where, yeah, you have this sort of like, you know, class-driven kind of leadership, but it did sort of like kind of open up space or an ability for lots of people who had never participated, like's been said before, to kind of like become active and get involved in these sort of things and start being able to speak out about them. But to sort of like kind of the general point you've mentioned about failure and looking at kind of the failures of these sort of things, I always get into this. It feels like just totally smashing my head against a wall sometimes with people, especially on the quote unquote left, about the failure to deal with failure. There's so many movements, whether you're talking about like the Marxists and their inability to comprehend their complete and abject failure over 150 years to make anything other than like a totalitarian state, or just the failure on more kind of the micro level around different sort of tactics that people get real sort of caught up in the nostalgia of like the mass sort of cultural movement of I Don't Know More, or about Standing Rock more recently. But, you know, you do have to recognize on some level that I Don't Know More didn't really accomplish its goals. I mean, I Don't Know More barely even had a goal, right? At least as far as I understood it. At least Standing Rock had a goal of resisting the pipeline, but was it actually successful? Not really. And we continue to kind of like, I mean, I'm Standing Rock of 4 years ago now. We continue to sort of just sit back here and think about, oh, you know, wasn't that great? We got so many thousands of people out, and all they did was get rained down with, like, you know, fire hoses, tear gas, and rubber bullets. To what end? And, you know, you then simultaneously you have to look at, like, what movements were a success, right? Like the Mi'kmaq out east a few years ago. Or even looking at Olga and things like that, or what was kind of the differences between them? Why did some succeed? Why did some fail? I was just talking to somebody this morning who was asking me about land back and about these sort of protest movements and the way that people, they want to go and they want to spray paint land back on like a sidewalk in front of a bank or something, and they were having trouble kind of processing what the intent or the goal of that was. And I said, you know, that's a lot of these movements, they just kind of get stuck with that sort of thing. But you look at something like, I told him about a Gunyage in New York, which was New York State, which was in the 70s, which was actually successful at what we might now today call land back. But what did they do? They actually went and like seized the territory and took it back. They didn't go and, you know, try and become social media influencers behind a hashtag, trying to, you know, push hashtag Gunyage or something. And you kind of really have to like get at the answer to those sort of questions about why were some successful, why were some failures. And I think maybe there is kind of this, like Gord said, petty bourgeois class interest where, I mean, I know I work in a university and I see it all the time where people, they don't want to talk, right? They'll offer these really great analysis of what the hell the problem is. But when it comes to the question of what to do about it, they'll give really, really vague platitudes or something like that. No one wants to, at least in the sort of environments I'm often in, no one wants to actually talk about, you know, what is to be done about these kinds of things. And I think we have to look at things like Oka. We have to look at things like the Zapatistas. We have to look at the Mi'kmaq out east and see where things have been successful and why.
I know that, like, so in my own experience in Indigenous organizing and resistance, like, what I have actually noticed is there's a curvature in terms of those that are engaged, all of us have all kind of been at different times exhausted and frustrated by the lack of support or the lack of resources or even the bullheadedness we're encountering in our own camps, as it were. What I kind of saw in this over this last decade, really from 99 forward, two decades now, was seeing that what I refer to as like not necessarily failure. I mean, it is obviously materially a failure of a lot of different tactics and strategies, but I actually think of it more as an exhaustion on the one hand of certain tactics and strategies, and then more importantly, that when you're engaged in struggle, we're the ones focused on struggle. At the same time, those that are kind of outside of it, I don't mean that they themselves aren't being affected by it, but those are not necessarily directly engaged. What's happened to them is they actually, their kind of level of participation, trust, and self-empowerment has to transform over time, right? And this is obviously, this is a nature versus nurture argument to some degree, in that some of us just have had fights since birth, you know? Others are more conflict avoidant. And then more importantly, we've had a kind of a problematic relationship at sometimes communicating the struggles or our aims of the struggles that we're engaged in. So when I kind of look at what we're going through, I kind of looked at I Don't Know More and went, okay, that's interesting. And then it allowed for the possibility. I knew it would fail before it began because of the domination of it as kind of a flash mob model, even though it did manifest differently in different places. But I was like, that's cool. That actually allows a differentiation between having the discussion of what a tactic is versus what a strategy or a movement is per se. And then by the same token, what Klee and Blon and I have all kind of discussed and other circles have discussed is this kind of this political moment that we're in, and that what I kind of see happening is a turning around and coming back to really our experiences from the margins of having been in this struggle, because what arguably like the petty bourgeois and liberal tactics themselves are failures. And so you have masses of people that are either A, disempowered and disillusioned, which is, I look at that not necessarily as a negative thing, but as like just the natural state. And or B, they're like, well, this didn't work. What's next? And all of a sudden, all those people that were fighting with us are looking back at us. And the examples that I immediately think of was, I was supposed to go out to Standing Rock. Certain things got in the way, but I was getting report backs the entire time Standing Rock was happening from Klee and from others. And some of the stuff we got back was really intriguing. Everything from how everyone that was fighting against the direct action elements, the moment that police repression began without provocation necessarily, were turning to the same direct action elements going, what do we do? So that was one element on the ground. Another element on the ground, of course, was I remember getting a callback about a council that was held. And at one point, the description I was hearing of the council was really funny, because you had pockets of organizations, activists, elders, what have you, each of them working on completely separate things, all of it prioritized as the thing that needs to happen. And then at the same time, you have the work that Canahus is doing and others are doing in Red Warrior Camp. And so I want to actually hear what Canahus has to say in terms of like the arc of that struggle, not necessarily even about the specificity of the pipeline and Standing Rock itself, but the tactics and encounters and where it has brought you now in terms of land occupation tactics, the sustaining of it, or even the aftermath in terms of repression or sacrifice.
I was right there in Standing Rock, and I, with my skills there, I assisted in putting together some just short films that were put on the Red Warrior social media pages. So I had up front, you know, camera footage of a team of women that came with different skills, audio skills and cinematography skills, and wanting to be able to put the truth out about what was happening on the front lines, and not being able to have cameras inside of the that camp that we were in. I always set up our encampment in my living space outside because I always had all the camera equipment and access to everybody that was on the front lines and their cameras, all of their, we had hard drives there uploading people's personal camera footage onto hard drives after between all actions, and every day being able to like just semi-edit some clips and be able to put it out because the next day there was more actions, and the actions start being more escalating, and the security around the construction sites end up being more heightened. And so there would be night actions, so people would give their communiques before they went to go lock down at night and stuff. And we start getting footage like that to be able to continue to get the footage out because people were fighting against the direct action. Like you said, there was different elements that wanted there not to be direct action, and the people, and for me coming from Suquamish territory and going into Hunkpapa territory, it was like I wanted to always connect to the Hunkpapa, like who is the people from that land that I'm actually on fighting for this land with. But yeah, I saw people using spiritual attacks. I saw people with my own eyes taking pipes out, like their sacred pipes and bundles, and like using it against the direct action by actually taking the pipe that they've loaded with tobacco and their prayers and pushing direct action warriors off front lines. I saw that with our own eyes, and people witnessed it. And that's like the PTSD that they're recovering from, is like actual the attacks from our own people that were so violent and so using spiritual abuse on the people to push people off the front line, or even using their own frontline security from the main camp to push direct action off the front line. And I saw that, and a lot of people witnessed that, and a lot of people will talk about it still today. And what I learned from that is that, yeah, like Gord said, 20,000 people, did they stop the pipeline? Like, did that form of direct action where we were being confronted by our own people and plus hundreds or thousands of cops from every different, there was Border Patrol there, there was freaking Homeland Security, there was all these state troopers from all the different states, there was like a conglomeration of all these different policing agencies where they were training them up in local forts in the area to get them trained up because they weren't trained up to standard of each other. Each place knew how they were going to do their riot control. So they were out there training with their training manuals that they had leaked to, you know, people in the movement. Like, this is what they're training off of right now as we speak, to know how they were moving on the people. And they used the basic, like, marching, you know, the cops marching with their shields and marching people directly off of the land. And so a lot of people don't know that Ocheti Sokoi and the camp that was set up really as an overflow from Sacred Stone and from where LaDonna had her camp, which was on reserve. Once you went on the other side of that camp in Ball River was so-called Army Corps engineer land, where it was just overflow and people start camping, and that was what got to known as that main camp. But the frontline camp, which was down the road further, was actually in the direct GPS coordinates on the path of the pipeline. And so that was the direct action camp. And there was just a few small numbers of hardcores that were camped at that camp out there on the front line, on the actual path of the pipeline. And that was what got removed on, I believe it was like, I want to say October 27th, because I just saw people posting a whole bunch of memories on their social media and stuff about that. But that's when they raided that frontline camp and marched everybody out. And that's where you saw a lot of scared people. And you saw where the people, the social media sensations that were down there were scared as fuck, you know, once there was like all those cops facing off with them. And they weren't frontline. They were in the in the safety zone away from the cops taking selfies and stuff. And so we saw that we didn't want our movement up here to be co-opted by like the selfie sensation nonprofit natives that are coming to continue to get a salary off of the movement when our people on the ground are the ones that struggle, their families sacrifice just as long, their kids sacrifice. Like, that's what we want. Like, we want people to know. And so in our movement here, we knew that one of the things is we could call on tens of thousands of people, but we're just spending, even if we spend a dollar a day to feed these people, that's $10,000 a day. You know, just the human cost, the financial cost of having like all those people there. Can we handle looking after all their physical amount of shit? Because porta potties became a fucking issue at Standing Rock. Became a real issue just being able to deal with thousands of people's of human waste. So yeah, we learned a lot of things, and we have tiny house lawyers now. We have like five tiny houses on wheels blocking this section, but this isn't our goal. We want to be able to strategically just place our homes in these tiny house on wheels because they've been using injunctions against us, and we have to be mobile fighting them too, because we saw our homes bulldozed down by the government too, doing land back and fighting for our territory and stuff. So every movement that I witness with my own eyes, it's just a blessing to me to be able to be on the ground in Hunkpapa territory, in an area where Sitting Bull and his people fought, and where they fought off actually railways from that exact location, you know, back in the day. So they resisted there against the railways and won. And that why their area, they needed to defend it. And so it's a powerful spot and a memory that I'll always keep, because you can see if we were organized in the skill sets we had, if we had a database where we can collect everybody's skill that was on the ground, and we had masterminds like people on this call possibly to come and look at everybody's skill set and put that together for a recipe of some type of success where we're actually going to win. And we do have that power to do that now, I believe, to all of our networks. We do have that collective intelligence to actually win and get organized. And that's what Standing Rock taught me, is we do have that, and we have the numbers if we can just do it and get organized.
In your introduction, you mentioned something about taking Indigenous struggles to the next level. And so, you know, stepping back, we're reflecting on some of the failures, some of the issues and challenges that we face as organizers, as folks either directly on the front lines, analyzing and dealing with this shit in real time, or now in retrospect, looking back at, you know, where some of the issues were. So I guess the question is, what do we mean by that next level? Like, what are the ways that we can look at this new opportunity, or this opportunity with land back, because we see land back lane, we see the Mi'kmaq uprising, resistance to white supremacist fascist attacks. And we look at what we're facing in our communities with this upcoming colonizers election, this theater of so-called democracy, and the acceleration of fascism that we face here. So I'm really interested in I guess exploring that more with y'all about what we mean by going up to the next level, learning from these challenges, and what ways we can seek these pathways forward. So part of the discussion that we wanted to have today was specifically about Indigenous anti-fascism, and both Inamiki and Gord, you have written a lot. You've published pieces, including a comic book, Gord, on anti-fascism. So I'd be really interested in exploring that question about what we mean by the next level. What ways can we learn from these experiences and be more effective in terms of these struggles?
Well, I think it's hard to say what the next level is, because, I mean, communities are all at different levels. I mean, some communities, Idle No More is going to be the next level, you know, so it there's a lot of variation, a lot of diversity in terms of capabilities in our communities. The other thing I would say is, you know, social movements, they're not just the product of like, we think it's a good idea. They're the product of material social conditions. social conditions are what really creates movements. And so that's what something I would keep an eye on is like, what social conditions are we living under? I mean, with the Mi'kmaq example, it's like a resource based struggle that they're engaged in right now. That's the social conditions that they're facing. But then we have to look at the bigger society, like what kind of changes are going to happen to the society? Like, what kind of systemic changes could we see happening in the next few years? And that's where you want to look at what's the next level possible for different movements. And then you have to look at geography or the terrain we're on. Like, this North America is a massive continent. If you just look at the mobilization for the Dakota Access Pipeline, you had like 20,000 people there at its peak. Those people came from all across North America to get there, and that is a major investment. That's a huge logistical challenge, like Canhuse is talking about. I don't know if that's going to be the next level, like mass gatherings like that. But I think the next level is going to be dictated by the social conditions and the geography. I mean, especially in the winter, we cannot organize caravans to go to Six Nations, for example. I don't believe. I think that would be too big of a challenge logistically in that. So the next level, I mean, I think it's going to be different for a lot of communities, but it's always going to be the product of the social conditions they exist under. If you have more of a systemic collapses or social crises happening, I mean, because you never know what's coming down the pipe, right? Like right now we have a COVID-19 pandemic, and it's in some ways it's kind of mild. I know you have over 200,000 deaths in the United States attributed to COVID, but that's the type of crisis, systemic change that it's hard to predict, but which can really change the social conditions that your movements are operating in. So it's really hard to say. I mean, the next level could be you could have guerrilla warfare breaking out in some part of the continent because the system has undergone so much change and decline, and the state is being hollowed out. I mean, it's really hard to say, but I mean, certainly you're going to see more militant resistance in the future. I have no doubt about that. You have the rise of heavily armed fascist far-right militia groups threatening people of color communities, including indigenous communities. And as a result of that, you have the mobilization of armed anarchist, leftist, black militias happening in the United States now. So that's another. That's, you know, that to me definitely is another level. So yeah, it's a pretty broad question, but I think it's kind of complex. And yeah, I'll leave it to others to say their opinions.
Well, and just to add to the complexity of how people might want to answer this question too, I'm really interested in hearing y'all's perspectives, excuse me, around the social conditions and gender and how those really influence like how movements are successful or turn out to be, I guess, failures in some ways. Because I think one of the things like I've witnessed and just I'm a lot younger than all of you, I'm going to assume, but just in the last, 8 or 10 years or so, I've noticed that a lot of more gender nonconforming folks and femme folks really leading a lot of these movements. And just to kind of touch on what Canhuse was saying earlier, you know, it might appear that like cisgender men like aren't participating as much anymore because of that. And they're not showing out in ways that maybe they used to when there were men leading some of the movements. I wanted to add in that layer too, because I think it's really important to talk about especially when we examine some of the ways that movements and history led by men haven't been maybe a success for like queer and femme folks. So maybe like adding in that, if we're talking about like land back and the conversation around like rematriation of the land and how we organize ourselves, I'd really love to hear y'all's thoughts on that as well.
It's also a polite way of saying our movements have been fucked up by cis-hetero patriarchy.
Thank you.
A lot of people have been upheld in these movements. A lot of perpetrators of sexual violence and interpersonal violence against our own communities, and people have been fucked up perpetuating trans and homophobia. So, you know, I'm curious as to way the strategies that people have had to confront that and make sure that we're not reinforcing that as well. So sorry, I'm adding on to that, but I just wanted to make sure that we're being clear and direct about that.
Definitely. Yeah. I can add more to that too, but I want to hear from everybody first. And specifically, I want to hear from Kana about that.
Yeah, I did my introduction and I talked about men. And I don't know.
Thank you for doing that.
But sometimes Creator just works in certain ways. And then I saw Klee and I saw Gordon and I was just like, oh my God, okay. Why did I end up saying men? Because they're two of the men I respect right there. But not talking about them, talking about that I had a lot of men in my movement and that I looked up to, my father, Wolverine, and they were men and they were right there by my side. I would stand with them along my raising myself and becoming more revolutionary and radical minded. In our movement, they helped me. Wolverine helped me a lot. I grew up with my dad, so yeah, he's just influenced me in many different ways. But Wolverine was someone who I really looked up to and traveled with him during his last years of his life. That really influenced me. So I connected with that man. I connect with different men in our movements. I know we need our men in our movements and stuff. And I think that yeah, being an all-female camp really scares some men away to be walking right into, when a lot of times we as Indigenous peoples are dealing with layers of sexual trauma and emotional trauma, physical trauma, all this genocide that has been inflicted on us that affects the interactions between like the man and the female and the trans and the, you know, all the people of our nations have people that have been affected by the sexual trauma inflicted upon us. That's the genocide of our people that nobody wants to talk about. So the dynamics, when you have females wanting to stand up and stand up against oppression, they're also standing up and saying, fuck the men that raped me, fuck those men that abused me, and standing up against the system and them seeing the cops at the blockade. It's all linked to themselves because they were bodies of traumas just because of our daily colonial life and everything, and just having to live within this fucked up reality that colonization is on our land. And so it affects us in different ways. But I want to say that in order, and I don't want to be a healing schmeeling, and I don't believe in all of that healing and schmeeling and stuff. I believe that we have to heal in a healthy way through our traditional foods and through our ceremonies and through our dances and singing loud on the blockades, and like a different healing that's going to take place. And those are going to be those men that come into our space that say, I'm here as a protector and a defender of our people. And right now it's land defenders are females. So we need our men beside us, because I feel that my arm would have never fucking, my wrist would have never been broken by the cops if I had some men on either side of me. And so, or some really badass fucking women that are the security force for our land defenders. You know, we do need a security force. We need to know that wherever there's people in our nation that want to do land back, people that want to do land defense to protect the area or just take land back, that there's some people, there's security that could defend them in it. Because as soon as you step foot to say land back, you're going to have police, you're going to have government, you're going to have white militia that form like here in Blue River and Clearwater and Valmont, all these redneck communities, and coming from the Alberta tar sands with Alberta plates with their dune buggies and snowmobiles harassing us because we're threatening their existence. You know, like, we need to look at different ways to resist together. Some people want to resist through let's do a sovereign cannabis dispensary that doesn't go through their license, and we get sovereign cannabis and we start taking over this industry as a way to land back, as a way to assert our Indigenous sovereignty. We have to be creative in our ways, and what is the next level how are we going to, like the old Wolverine said, like we're being held hostage in Canada, like politically, socially, economically, we need to get outside of the country, you know, and he always talked about our legal fight, but we have an economic place in this world as well. And we're not about destroying our land for money, but we're about, we can be powerful land owners of our land. You know, we need to, those, I feel that's another next level is what, how do we build our plans for the future, self-determination plans for food security and sovereignty, for birthing our babies outside of the system? Like, what's our plan to get to the next level on every forms, not just resistance, direct action? Yes, 1492 land back, that's next level for us. You know, like, I like to see that. I like the visual. I love the optics of what that creates in my warrior spirit to want to fight back harder and use some of their tactics here. And so women are a part of every movement. And even on 1492, there's women there. You know, women and men, when they work together, are more powerful. And we need to figure out how in our healing process as radical revolutionary people of all sex and can come together and fight, because we're stronger when we're together. And so we can't have the same movements that have just been led by men. We can't have just the movements that have just been led by women. We need to find ways where radical freaking people can work together so we can, you know, fight the most powerful we can with both of the masculine and feminine energy in this universe. Strength.
Following up just like real quickly on that, I could just hear a lot of listeners potentially like hearing what you just said, Kanahus, and being like, well, that just sounds like patriarchy. But I just want to like emphasize that indigenous like patriarchy does not equal white settler colonial patriarchy. So it's important to like compartmentalize when we say something like we need our men to protect us. That doesn't mean the same thing as like how that might like come off in the context of how we understand patriarchy on like a broader, like for us, like Americanized masculinity type of level. And you know, when we talk about movements like this, and I find this specifically true in indigenous-led movements, there is kind of like that language used around like men and women, and a lot of times we forget how when we say and speak like that, we like exclude our two-spirit and like gender non-conforming folks from having recognition for how they're contributing to the movements too. So just a few follow-up things from everything you were saying, Kanahus. But yeah, I'd still really like to hear from Gordon and Namaki on those issues too.
Could I just say something too? Just could I say something right before you start, just to spin off of what you said, is that it's never my intention, and I feel like as Indigenous people, we're just fresh into the English language, and that when we're talking, right, we want to be speaking and we want to be politically correct in our Indigenous ways. We want to say that, but we are just fresh into using English, and we mean everybody. Hukwai to sweat in our language, Hukwai to sweat means like all of our people. And no matter what. So that's what I mean when I say that, just to, and yeah, when we talk, people can't ever really come from our worldview as Indigenous people, and especially Indigenous women and females and femmes and two-spirit. We can't, no one could ever come from our angle, because only we can. And we know that we've been the most oppressed, we've been the most over-policed, the most underprotected out there. And we're going to rage, and we're going to fight back, and we're going to not let no type of masculine energy stand in that way of us. And meaning, and everything in the white way of masculine energy, meaning to please the white government, the white colonials, everybody that comes to our front of our blockade. Like, our blockade is where we fucking meet head on with the colonial government right there. They don't step past that blockade. When the cops come, they scream from the other side, "Could I we say something to you?" Like, no, they know they're not walking on that side. Like, blockades are necessary, and we need everybody to know that as Indigenous people, our worldview is completely different, because every waking hour we're under the reality that there's a genocide and our land continues to be occupied and invaded every second of the day. We are in combat mode. We are in battle mode. We are in a constant war mode as Indigenous people, and especially ones that are resisting up front and the front. And so, just to make that clear, when I speak, I'm not speaking from a normal housewife perspective of people don't even know where we're coming from as Indigenous people. They need to know we're on a battle mode right now.
Yeah, I was going to say, to address some of the comments, I mean, I think historically, like, you can look at some movements, like the American Indian movement was definitely, in my opinion, was definitely dominated by men. It was a very strong male leadership that drove that movement. I think with some of the other big acts of resistance, like with Oka, I mean, you saw strong women leadership, and then you also had the warriors who were kind of in the background, you know, engaging in this armed resistance. Idle No More was started by four women, and they provided the leadership for that movement. Elsie Pugtug, I think, again, you're back in like a kind of an Oka situation where you had a warrior society, and then you had some women leadership, spokespeople role type of thing. So I think there's been some variety. But what I have seen is some of these campaigns begun by women, and it's kind of been left to them, and men haven't really participated very much. And it's hard to say, but I think, like, a lot of situations they're all kind of unique. They all have a certain context of why people are joining a struggle, participating in it. I think for some men, I think they look at some of these campaigns and there's this kind of warrior mentality that it's like, okay, when things get real, give me a call. And that's, you know, kind of a macho posturing thing, because a lot of the work that's done in these movements isn't, like, I think what a lot of guys think their role is going to be, because we're not actually engaging in this big armed battles right now. And that's, I think, a lot of guys kind of fantasize that that would be their role. Like, when stuff gets serious, they're going to come in with the AK-47 and they're going to be the hero. And that's not the real world, because the real world is actually podcasts and all this other organizing that enables the direct action campaigns to happen. And I think a lot of guys, they probably don't even have the skills to do a lot of the other stuff. And they think their only contribution is going to be this kind of a heavy duty security force. So I think there's, like, cultural and social things that are influencing, you know, where men think they can fit in or where they think they're going to be comfortable. But it's a pretty big thing, but it varies a lot. Like, I mean, tomorrow we could have a campaign start up that's, like, you know, kind of what we think an Indigenous struggle will look like. Like, you're going to have a lot of men, a lot of women, a lot of transgender people, just the diversity that's in our communities participating. I mean, and that's one thing you could look at, is like when the whole community is actually engaging in a struggle, you do actually have a lot of all those components that, you know, sometimes are missing from one struggle and, you know, the president another. But I think when you do have a whole community mobilizing, engaging in stuff, you have all that diversity and you have men participating, women participating, and transgender people and all that. It's hard to nail it down and say, oh, well, this, you know, men don't do this or women do this. Like, it's not always like that. So I think a lot of things, it's context based. And there are cultural problems, I would say, with a lot of men and what they think their role is. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to... I don't even know where to start, right? Because so much has already been said by Conahus and Gore, but and by Vaughn. I think a lot of it's really important to think about. I mean, I think my nation, the Menominee, we had a, I guess you'd call it a land back occupation back in the 70s of this Catholic novitiate that was near our res. Because at the same time, we had been what's the word? We're the federal government. Derecognized us in the 50s. We were one of the guinea pigs for that. And so we had this movement to get recognition back, but also this land back movement. And the recognition sort of movement, I mean, we can be critical of recognition from the colonial state, but that was led by women from our nation. Whereas this more warrior camp was run by the Menominee Warrior Society, and it was predominantly all men, and there was this specific split along gender lines and around patriarchal lines, because in part of what had animated this novitiate occupation was this line of skirts out. They wanted to return to what they perceived to be the traditional patriarchal sort of governance structures of our nation, which was really bullshit, but it was as much a reaction to the women leadership of the primary struggle our nation was engaged in at the time, as much as it was like a struggle over land back. And I think to kind of like speak to some of the stuff that we were talking about, like next levels, and Gord really kind of like brought up really well this the question of like material conditions, I guess I would call them. Speaking from like an organizational or organizing kind of perspective, I always think that material conditions drive everything. And it's real hard to talk about next levels from an organizer's perspective, because quite often material conditions will push everyday people ahead of the organizers. You see that a lot of what happened in the U.S. this summer, where I don't think any fucking organization, anarchist, communist, whatever, foresaw that the material conditions of police brutality in the United States were going to push people into open rebellion the way it has. And so I think organizers are quite often left in the dust by actual revolutionary people in motion. And to connect that with like this gender and sexuality question of the leadership of our movements, I think when you have these kind of multiple converging sets of material conditions of not just colonization but also colonial patriarchy, I think that kind of inevitably is going to push a lot of women and gender non-conforming, non-male, non-het kind of people in our nations, in our communities, to kind of move first. If anything, just because the colonial violence directed against them is much more acute because of these intersections of colonialism and gender. But I do think it's incredibly important for men to not just sit it out. Like Gord was saying, this is really, I've witnessed this a lot in my off and on like 15 years being involved in our movements, of this kind of macho posturing that, you know, they think we're gonna swoop in with AK-47s and RPGs or something and save the day. But men have to insert themselves in the movement at like a much more kind of like everyday practical level, right? You need people to help run camps. You need people to feed people at camps, construct barricades, construct structures, all that sort of stuff, right? We can't just leave that to, honestly, the most oppressed people in our communities to do that. We have to be involved with that from like the jump as well. And I think there's a, you know, again, on the patriarchy, I think it's been said a few times, right, like that men might see these feminine or non-masculine dominated kind of spaces and get turned off by it. Like I said, that's why the first thing I led with was like thinking of my own community's kind of experience with this, right? So we have, as men, we have to kind of overcome this so that we can insert ourselves into it. And I think it's really important to take leadership on a lot of questions from our sisters from the people in our community who are trans or who are queer or something like that, and actually be mindful of who we're elevating. You can have a lot of movements that say that, and Klee and I have talked about this a little bit with a certain Native leftist organizing group in the Southwest that says quite often that they are predominantly queer and like women led, but my major critique of the group is that really they're kind of like behind the shadows. Paramount leader is like this cishet dude, right? And they're not actually, in my opinion, elevating indigenous, queer, and trans, and two-spirit and women kind of leadership. And I think that's really important to do.
If I can add something, and just to make a point, I think for our listeners, is that cis heteropatriarchy has invaded our communities. We can't deny that. We cannot ignore that. And in many ways, there's a conflation, or our people have conflated some tradition or conservative elements of who we are and identified that with our traditional cultural knowledge systems. And that needs to be untangled as part of the healing process. So I'm with you on the healing, what you talked about, Kanahus, as part of that. And so for me, the position I have is that, queer indigenous feminism is necessary to intervene in these spaces, and we have to center trans, gender nonconforming folks as well in these spaces as much as possible, because we can look back at the legacy of AIM. We can look back at the legacy of all these other fucked up movements. And so I'm really interested in fucking up those spaces and challenging that and saying this is a priority. We need to confront and heal as we move forward. We can do this in real time because we can fucking multitask.
There's also no quick fix, right? This idea that one, tokenism would in any way, shape, or form could actually get us ahead is improper. The thing that I think that there has to be is actually the stuff that goes undiscussed or is discussed behind the scenes. So, for example, deconstructing ideas of gender themselves as being colonial constructs in and of themselves, be them trans, be them cis, be them whatever, and instead re-exploring what they are within our own indigenous context and specifically within tradition, because there's no universal, native tradition or that we all have the same ideas. It's just not a fact. That's just an illusion. But by the same token, some of the stuff that's missing that I've seen that we have to really put out there is accountability and responsibility and defining those things. That's actually why, even though I'm a member of multiple warrior societies, I've been a member of AIM and all those sorts of things, that term always bothers me. Because it actually does manifest more often than not by people whose behavior undermines what that means, at least in the way I was taught it. And in that case, they actually manifest toxic behaviors, total disregard for accountability and responsibility, and instead embrace a notion of posturing and egotism. And the reason I bring that up is because when it comes down to it, it doesn't matter who it is when there's no accountability and no responsibility. And because we have plenty of toxic actors of all types, of every gender, of every political persuasion, of every age, and we don't have a lot of mechanisms for dealing with them. And also we don't have a lot of, not necessarily even institution building, but mechanisms by which we can confront certain situations. So, for example, here locally, I was speaking with a well-known local California indigenous activist, and I was telling her, like, the problem I see is one, I've been ineffectual personally, but I own that, right? But more importantly, I was like, what I saw over the last year around missing and murdered indigenous women and trans and two-spirit folks, what here locally was, there was at least three indigenous women that she knew personally, directly. As their crisis unfolded, she ended up dealing with the crisis by herself, there was no institution that we had developed in order to actually enable, you know, and support families that were in crisis, to support organizers that were trying to do anything, be it just dealing with lawyers or the system or getting medical care or child care or what have you. And what I saw instead was a lot of discussion around, in terms of reflecting back on the work that were being done. It's something around land is concrete, something around internal issues where we're not dealing with and confronting our own toxic elements seems inconcrete because it's so abstract until it hits you in the face. And that's actually been exactly something that has been come up with me multiple times. In fact, a perfect example was one of the odder conversations I had was during Standing Rock, when someone is calling me asking for tips about how to deal with infiltration and predation that's occurring and creating systems of accountability. I'm 1,000 miles away. I shouldn't have been the one that was contacting for that. And it said, and that doesn't mean I didn't help how I could, but it meant that there was nothing on site at the moment in which we needed it most. And I've seen it again and again and again, where those inability to navigate these behaviors and these individuals, because it's always someone and their behaviors and tactics that actually prevents us from the ability to move forward. I've seen it undermine organizations, movements, actions, you name it. And it isn't as simple as the stereotypical toxic masculinist behavior. The only reason I bring that up is because, for example, in the fascism zine that we republished, the fascism zine starts with the caricature of the president, right? And the threat that this person represents. I look at that as that's the typical caricature that we're encountering. A bombastic, egomaniacal person that comes in and is accountable to no one, responsible for nothing, and then walks out leaving chaos in his wake. And that's exactly what we're encountering again and again and again in microcosm. And so I'm curious to see, what are some of your experiences collectively with dealing with and or creating mechanisms by which to reestablish community trust, community accountability, responsibility, and a recultivation of a new form of participation and engagement within these struggles?
Well, this is Anamaki. I hear what you're saying a lot. There's a problem I've encountered it a lot. I mean, just in the city that I live in Southern Ontario, of, I guess we would call them narcissistic personality types in terms of these sort of people. I've encountered them both in Indigenous activist kind of spaces and in non-Indigenous sort of leftist anarchist kind of spaces as well, and it can be incredibly destructive. Right now in our city, we've got they're calling themselves a land back camp, but a lot of the people who are leading it, there are other critiques to be made of some of the personalities, but some of the main ones are these incredibly self-centered, performative, bombastic people who aren't really accountable to anybody, but it's actually destroyed a lot of people's ability to involve themselves in the struggle, because they speak out against these people. They are able to mobilize their social capital that they've accrued and silence people. And they just generally kind of push a lot of people who are interested in becoming involved out of these spaces. I burnt a lot of my bridges locally this summer for deciding that really me and some other people, such as my sister and some other friends of ours, had enough of this shit and decided to speak out about it. And torched a lot of connections with that because people just didn't want to fucking hear it. But at the same time, a lot of people came to me privately and said, Jesus, thank you for speaking out. We've had these problems with these sort of personalities in our spaces, and we've had to leave movements, we've had to leave spaces because of these kind of personalities. I mean, unfortunately, because those sort of experiences for me are like right now, happening right now, I haven't really been able to put a lot of time into thinking about what to do about it, because I'm still sort of myself processing the destruction that they can cause in our kind of movement spaces. So I don't know if I have anything to say about what do we do about it? How do we reconnect, or how do we rebuild? But just, I really want to echo that it is, I think, incredibly important to kind of talk about that in general.
Part of the introduction for our show, we say, may the bridges we burn light our way. So it's right in that same spirit.
I think a lot of these types of problems that were like the narcissistic individuals who gain power and control in a group. I mean, I think these things are like very old problems in human society. I mean, there's always been this problem. It's not like we've got an indigenous movement and now suddenly we've got a problem with people coming in and doing this. So it's always going to be, it just depends, again, context based. I mean, some movements arise and they're healthy. They have healthy people that are of good minds and good spirits, and they're organizing and they're working together with people. And another place, that same, under the same banner, you can have a group start up that's actually controlled and dominated by some narcissistic power tripping, ego tripper, whatever. And you've lost that one in a sense, right? Like you have people who establish cults, and you can see the same dynamics in our movements. You basically have a cult established in your city and people are following it, and people are either going to see through it and leave, or they're going to continue to, keep participating in it. And over years, an individual who is scorned by the movement generally can still have a following and still have an influence and still be able to interject themselves in a struggle at a certain time and have an influence, a negative influence. So these things are, it's a part of a human problem, like a human society. We're always dealing with groups and individuals having power over groups. So I don't think it's just a specific problem for social movements or radicals or something like that. You can look at human society, the same problem perpetuates itself. How do you deal with it? Sometimes you're successful and you're able to deal with it. You can expose an individual or a group of individuals for what they are, and other people will see it. At other times, you just have to walk away because those people have, you know, they're going to follow that leader until the bitter end. But yeah, that's what I think.
and I bet if we all shared some of our traditional histories, we have stories with characters like that that are cautionary tales. So we've been through this. And we just have to look back at our ancestors' experience to inform how to address that. You know, interestingly enough, a lot of those tools are already there. But I'm really just curious, especially in terms of the powerful movement to address missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, trans, and two-spirit folks, and the actions that have been taken and helped to, in the ways that that organizing has informed some of the work that y'all have been doing, especially Kanahus with Tiny House Warriors. I know you've been doing some really powerful actions. Your camp is women led there as well. If you can talk just about that, the death of reconciliation, the sort of liberal politics with indigenous land acknowledgements as well, and you know how that relates to the sort of acceleration of fascism, whether it's from state forces or white supremacists that are being emboldened by the Trump administration as well.
Yeah, I think that the whole oil and gas boys and the oil and gas industry is all linked to the whole Trump mentality of making money off of the theft of Indigenous lands. And here in so-called British Columbia, Canada, it's just been very a short time in the history in comparison to other Indigenous nations across Turtle Island that has been occupied and colonized, and here where I'm at right now is in a very remote area of our territory, and we're located along Highway 5, which is the corridor, transportation corridor for the CP Rail, the Yellowhead Highway, and the Trans Mountain Pipeline Corridor. So everything follows the path of the least resistance, and it's this transportation corridor that's coming from landlocked parts of the prairies and Alberta landlocked resources. In this case, this bitumen from the Alberta tar sands coming all the way through our lands, 518 kilometers of our territory. But no matter if it was a man camp for the men that came in to build the highways, or the men that came in to build the railway, or the men that came in to build the original 1951 pipeline, there was women raped. There was women sexually attacked. No matter what, these industries are bringing this to our lands, and this mentality of rape the land, is the same mentality of I can rape these women. You know, I can sexually violate these women. And because Indigenous women are the most vulnerable, the least protected, they're the ones that are being attacked. And so we have tens of thousands, and since contact, I say hundreds of thousands of Indigenous women that have been disappeared or murdered. And my grandma being one of the murdered of this list. So violence has been, this colonial violence against women has always been, yeah, and sister says millions, like across our whole world and Turtle Island. And so we're being affected, and just as a female, traditionally in our societies before white men came to our land, we were able to live a decolonial life. We're able to live free. We're able to feel protected by our family systems and our warrior societies and just the warriors within our nation and the men and the protectors. We're able to feel safe. Now, because there's police and laws and all this colonial invasion, we as don't feel safe. We don't feel safe even going and getting land back by ourselves. We have to have our warriors, our protectors that are willing to go to battle just to be here, just to say, hey, we're stopping a man camp. And these man camps are so violent because you're bringing all of these men, mostly transient men that are going from job to job, to these work camps, and you're taking them away from their wives or any type of sexual interaction with anybody else, and you're putting them in these camps where they're surrounded with 1,000 men. Now we're getting testimonials from Indigenous women that are forced into the sex trade up around, in and around the Alberta tar sands, that are brought into these camps. Young men that are brought into these camps, forced into this the sex trade because of our fucking situation of impoverishment and addictions and everything that comes from this colonial violence inflicted upon us, like all of the symptoms of colonization. And you go to any of these communities. I mean, I ran with the Peace and Dignity run, like actually physically ran with the Peace and Dignity journeys that ran from Alaska all the way to Panama. And I ran from Alaska and all the way through BC, and we ran through the Highway of Tears. But every community, all the way from Alaska, they're talking about the truckers, and they're saying the missing and murdering Indigenous women. And every community we stopped at, the topic was the murdered and missing Indigenous women, because we had prayer staffs and they were praying for their women that have gone missing on that highway. And this is north of Highway 16, the Alaska Highway. And so this Highway 16 that is known as the Highway of Tears, it continues on to all of these highways and corridors that are connected to the any and all industry that Canada is based off of and built its superpower wealth off of, the extraction of these resources off of Indigenous territories, but the use of their transportation corridors to get those landlocked resources to tidewater to even make it of any type of value. And so it's all linked, like the poverty that is on our people right now. When you add up all the Indian reserves equals 0.2%. So not even 1% of land base, 0.2% of land base that Indians, natives, indigenous peoples in Canada are forced onto 0.2%. And Canada got very wealthy, wealthy, wealthy off of the rape of our territories, off of that remaining 99.8% of land, and even including that 0.2% because they invade reserve lands all the time. And so we're at this place where I think we need to expand our movements to what my father would always do, like, no, we got to get, he brought it to NAFTA, brought it to WTO and say, hey, Canada's trying to play this game. And they're trying to sell the software for so cheap because they're subsidizing off of not recognizing Indigenous title and Indigenous rights to that land that you stole those software trees from. And so you get into a different arena where you could start to affect the economic system. You could start to affect the accounting systems and that structure of that our whole, the whole wealth of these colonial states have been able to be superpowers to continue to oppress us, and start to get into that game and that ballpark when you start to say, let's affect billions of dollars of your money. And that's what tiny house warriors and being able to use, not use, like for these women to create this tiny house warriors that was going to be building 10 tiny houses on wheels to place in the strategic places along the pipeline to block and stop construction, and saying, no, they need the man camps to be built, and we need to amplify as well as join this movement of families who are crying out for their loved ones that are murdered or missing, and how this industry has played a big part of creating this mentality that you can disappear our women and nothing would be done about it. That they even had a federal inquiry into it and admitted there's a race-based genocide against Indigenous women and girls in this evil invading country called Canada. And it continues to happen every day. And, you know, there's all young femme and two-spirit here. That's all that comes here to the camp. And I'm like, why is that? That's why I started out, where are men? Why are these women just standing up and fighting back? And it's all, you know, and it almost brought tears in my eyes just seeing their photos of the couple of days I was gone to see, hey, these are just all young women, because they're like, yes, our auntie's back. And they were so happy that I got back here to the camp. And I just looked at all of them, and they were all women, young women holding it down here. So, yeah, it's just powerful how everything happens, and even what I said right now. But thank you for just letting me share that.
Yeah, thank you. And what I hear a lot from you is a call for that warrior spirit and for folks to show up in that way. And what I also hear in the threads of the discussion that we're having is that it needs to be done in a critical way that addresses cis heteropatriarchy and a range of issues that we don't perpetuate from the other problematic legacies of movements that we've experienced. We have to learn from these fucking lessons. And so I wanted to bring it, as we start closing up this show, to the piece Fascism and Anti-Fascism, A Decolonial Perspective, that Enamiki, that you published some time ago. And one of the points that you made in there, when you, because you identify, you define what fascism, and you ask the question, what does fascism mean to Indigenous people? Is it even a useful analytic category for us in the light of existent settler colonialism? So the question was, what does anti-fascism mean to us in the light of struggle for decolonization? But you specifically said that you're building on this recognition of fascism as colonial violence turned inward. We are then immediately confronted with the truth that the terrain for even the responsibility of development of a domestic fascist movement in North America is a terrain. And so you explore this idea of a terrain below fascism and intersections of Black and Indigenous struggles. So I wanted to ask you about that, because the primary question you pose in that piece is, how do we fight fascism? And I think that that's sort of what we're leading towards. And perhaps we can wrap up this conversation with this, because Kanahus is putting a call out for warriors. And so how do we fight fascism? And do we also identify this fight on those terms? Is that useful for us in our communities, in these fights, whether we use the hashtag land back or not?
Right. Well, I mean, in terms of like the utility of fascism as a concept, like an analytic, as you said, I do think there is a usefulness of it just in distinguishing certain, I guess we could call them, categories of threat, right? I don't tend to refer to someone like Trump as a fascist. I know that's pretty popular to do. I think there's been some real kind of like insightful discussion of this from kind of left forces like Jay Sakai and Matthew Lyons and whatever, where we're talking about this distinction between system loyal rightists and insurgent rightists, or Lyons calls them insurgent supremacists, right? Where you have these people like, say, Trump, where Trump's whole rallying cry has been to make America great again, right? They just see this bombastic need to revive the American frontier spirit, right? But the project still basically remains America for them, or remains Canada. But then you have a lot of these rightist forces, and maybe the thing that loses some sort of cachet is fascism as a term, because we talk about fascism and we tend to conjure these images of, like, you know, Nazis, whether they're kind of like 1930s cosplayers in brown shirts, or they're Nazi punks, or the National Socialist Movement. But there's also people who aren't necessarily fascists in that regard, who are like what they would call like Christian dominionists and stuff, like those sort of Christian fundamentalists who want to completely remake America as this, like, you know, Bible theocracy. And then you have all these kind of patriot movements where they're not even really concerned with race or even religion, but they want this kind of unbridled, no limits capitalism, right? And so Lyons talks about the two kind of salient points being, one, that these forces see inequality and things like that as natural or desirable or good, and two, and this is what really differentiates them from people like Trump or sort of like right-wing forces we have in Canada, is that they see kind of the current system as one that has to be done away with, right? So when I wrote that article, I said that maybe people in Trump's circle were themselves fascists. Like Steve Bannon used to talk about himself as a Leninist because he said his politic was that he wanted to destroy the state, right? So when you look at some of these like actual like fascist forces, they don't give a shit about preserving America, right? I have a friend who calls them Americaners, right? Thinking of Afrikaners in South Africa, where so a lot of them are actually quite willing to cede huge swaths of the United States to, say, a Chicano nation or in the Southwest, or a Black nation in the Southeast, and even indigenous territory, so long as they're able to maintain kind of some sort of like white heartland. Or you get the whole migration that's been going on for decades of white supremacists to the American Northwest, because they don't give a shit about preserving what's in D.C. or in Ottawa. They want to separate off and form their own state, right? So they kind of like thirst for like a new frontier and like a rebirth of this sort of like settler violence. But the main threat, so I do think fascism or like the far right or whatever we want to call it is still kind of useful in that sort of sense, because I think some of these forces present like a maybe a more sort of like more pressing kind of like a presentation of violence, right? In that they're probably, you know, they're willing to not just fight us like the state is, but they're willing to like fight the state itself. And I mean, that does lead some people. I mean, there's a whole kind of left wing problem with like red brown alliances, where people are just willing to see anti-state kind of rhetoric and think, oh, we can work with that, you know, and you have to be kind of aware of these other sort of issues. But in terms of the train below fascism, right, as I called it, and thinking of this colonial violence turned inwards, I think A lot of people, I was thinking about this before we did the show, that people talk about America or Canada is already fascist or has always been fascist. And I don't know if that is like a useful way to talk about it, because if you look at Hitler, you look at these other prototypes of the fascists in Europe, they modeled themselves on the United States. They modeled themselves on Canada. So you could say that Hitler was already America, and I think that's maybe more useful, because we as indigenous people or black people have always kind of dealt with this like unending genocidal violence. Maybe sometimes it's more intense, like, you know, during the Indian Wars or the Northwest Rebellions in Canada, but it's never stopped. I think fascism to white people, more or less, only becomes this like question when the violence that their country has been raining down on indigenous people, onto black people, onto people all over the third world, when it like becomes their problem, when the troops, so to say, come back and turn their guns on them. That's when everyone starts talking about fascism. I think there's a similar discourse where I talk to a lot of white leftists, and they talk about like the rebirth of COINTELPRO, and I say, well, COINTELPRO never went the fuck away. They just stopped targeting you guys. They didn't think that white communists or white anarchists or something presented a serious threat to the coherence of like the settler state. But black people, native people, we've always presented a threat to them. So they've always, they infiltrated us. They put our movements down. They murdered our leaders before COINTELPRO was a thing, and they kept doing it after COINTELPRO was a thing. You know, we were the original sort of like enemy terrorists before 9/11. And so that's why I say that I think if you really want to talk about like the defeat of fascism, and this is true for the defeat of capitalism or the defeat of ecocide or anything like that, is we really have to kind of like center the struggle against colonization, right? Which you might call land back, you might call decolonization or something like that, because I think you have to really talk about making America or making a Canada cease to exist, right? I just say that, right? Like, you know, Canada and America need to go the fuck away. And when that happens, then we can kind of like deal with like whatever we're going to create in their ashes. But then you don't even have the possibility of fascism then, you know, at least fascism imagined as this like white frontier violence come back or something.
And Gord, you wrote a comic book, Antifa comic book, 100 Years of Fascism and Anti-Antifa Movements. I'm curious as to your perspective on that.
One, the
perspective and the diagnosis of fascism in the U.S. context, I guess, and perhaps in the so-called Canada context, like, do you agree with Inamiki that it's maybe not necessarily fascism? Maybe there's a definition sort of difference there, because I think the differentiation is important. And then perhaps, like, you know, the main question is, how do we fight fascism?
I think in the times we're living in now, I think it is useful. I think it's useful for indigenous people to be informed about the rise of these fascist groups, fascist movements, the violence that they're carrying out. And I think in a lot of indigenous communities, I mean, there is awareness that there has been a rise in fascist, far-right, neo-Nazi movements with the election of Trump, because Trump has really energized and empowered the far right, not just in the United States, but also in Canada and around the world. So I think a lot of indigenous people are following this. They're aware of this. I think a lot of indigenous people are intuitively anti-fascist because they understand what the goals of fascists are and white supremacists. They have a basic understanding of Nazi Germany. So I think a lot of indigenous people are anti-fascist. I think in some areas, it should probably be more of a priority for organizing, because the community is going to face a bigger threat from the far right and fascists. I mean, I think down in your area, I think anti-fascism would be an important component of an indigenous movement. Because you have an armed threat. I think that's one of the big things about the fascist far-right movement we're seeing, is that it presents an armed threat. And I think one of the ways of defeating fascism is through armed resistance. I mean, certainly that's the history of when you have serious fascist movements arise, it's armed resistance that ultimately defeats them. And when you're below that, you have militant anti-fascism is very important. Like I'm thinking of, for example, in Britain or Germany, you don't have these armed movements as much. So you have militant anti-fascism is very important. I think in the United States, because you have such an armed right wing, I think armed resistance, it needs to be an important part of any anti-fa organizing. I think indigenous communities need to take that into account and think about their security. It may not be armed because it's going to be, you know, based on their situation, but it is a threat. You have the militia groups that are, you know, intertwined with the fascist far right, and they're organizing in Canada as well. We have 3%ers up here. We had the Soldiers of Odin, which wasn't an armed group, but certainly a kind of a paramilitary style that they were promoting. So I think in this time and place, it is important to have an analysis of the rise of these fascist movements and whatnot. I think anti-fascism is an important component that, you know, in some areas I think would be more important. I think one of the things about anti-fascism, like back in the 90s when I was more involved in street anti-fascist work, I mean, we found it actually, like, it was actually helpful because we could get people organizing and get them mobilizing and participating in our movement, because they had something real that was, you know, some people have a problem with, like, the theory and the petitions and the rallies, and the fascist threat actually helped us mobilize people a little bit better because they found it's a threat and they could contribute to it and they could have victories. You know, you could drive the fascists off the street, you could cancel their event, you could disrupt their organizing. So in that way, and I think that's part of what's happening in the United States right now with this huge surge in anti-fa organizing over the last 4 years. I think a part of it is it's very tangible for people to get involved in. They have immediate satisfaction. You know, you drive the fascists off the street. You have defeats that make you withdraw and think about the tactics that you're doing. So this is all very, very radicalizing for people being involved in this struggle over the last 4 years. But with indigenous people, like what I said when I first started talking is, like, a lot of our struggles are very local, regionally based. They're not always influenced by these bigger movements because, like, it's something that's happening in the backyard and, you know, your community is now mobilizing to deal with it. And a lot of the people in the community, you know, they may not be following too much of these other social movements, but they'll become really involved in a local struggle. But I think at the end of the day, the anti-fascist thing is very important for us all to kind of embrace, because that could be the big threat we're going to face as a society. Is this threat from the far right. And that could really help unify a lot of people, you know, like, you know, a lot of indigenous people. And also I would throw in with that the fascist threat. I would throw in with that the police violence. So you have this large anti-police brutality, police murder movement that's arisen. And that really resonates with indigenous peoples as well, because of the violence and repression they face from police. So I think, like, along with the anti-police thing, I think the anti-fascist thing could actually be a very unifying thing if it becomes such a paramount problem that a lot of energy is going to be focused on dealing with fascist groups, militia groups. And I think that is something that could become more pronounced in the future. I mean, even if Trump is defeated in the election, I mean, if you look at the trend over the last couple decades, whenever a Democrat was elected, you had a big resurgence of the militia movement, and that that trend, you know, when you had a Republican in as a president, then you had kind of a die down, a slackening of the militia thing. But with Trump, it's different, because when Trump got elected, then you still had this huge resurgence of militia organizing. And so if he's defeated by a Democrat, you're going to see this a different kind, but you're still going to see the continuation of these militia groups, but you might see even more active organizing on their part, because now they feel there's a real threat because there's a Democrat in the White House. So I think looking down the road, like, I think it is important. Anti-fascism is important now, and I think it could become even more important. I think armed self-defense is important now, and I think down the road it could become even more important. And I think really what we need to be looking at is, like, it's kind of like a multinational resistance movement that's, you know, unifying, you know, indigenous people, black people, Chicano, Latino people, and white people as well. So I think that's a really an important thing to kind of look at in the big picture, because we could be facing, much more severe repression than we're facing now in the future. Yeah.
I mean, our position has been that, like, obviously, no matter who wins in this colonial theater of democracy, we're still going to face resource colonialism. We're still going to face what we understand as accelerated fascism as well. And so we need to be prepared even more so to address that and find ways to be as effective as possible. So as we're closing up the show now, we wanted to experiment with this new part of the show that's sort of like a call outs or shout outs, or just any last closing thoughts that you want. So if there's any call outs, like any problematic organizations or tendencies, I know we already sort of talked about Idle No More, so maybe you got that off your chest, but perhaps it's a cathartic opportunity to just to be like, name names or name orgs or name tendencies that need to be addressed. But then also as part of that, a shout out for groups, organizations, or individuals or tendencies that you want to see empowered and help uplift them as well. Even if it's your own projects that you're working on. So this is a call to action point. And if you don't want to do any of that, just some closing remarks as we end this show. And I just really want to thank you all for taking the time, for sharing. I know this conversation could probably be extended much, much longer because there's a lot of threads that we have sort of opened up. And I hope that we do, and hope you will come back to join us to deepen these conversations. So, Hyehet. And I'd like to bring Kanahus to start with closing us off with that.
Yeah, I don't know about call-outs, but I guess down with the whole rotten-ass system. And shout-outs, I want to say shout-outs to, like, 1492 Land Back Lane, like, for standing up and just doing what they did and blockading more invasion. And shout-out to all the women warriors out there that are having their babies undocumented and not registering them in the system and not depending on their government money. That really means a lot to me and keeping me out here too. Shout out to my children who have to sacrifice all the time, and now they're going to be spending a month on the blockade with me. And to all of you, just shout out to Gord, because he always brings new reflections and insights and everything to all of us Indigenous people, especially here at unceded territories in so-called BC. And shout out to you, Clea, and your warrior wife for doing the work you do and continue to bring just a real radical, revolutionary Indigenous mindset for us to look at and know, like, oh, there's not just the Idle No More people and not just the people who are more soft. We can pick it up to the next level, like, people that aren't scared to say things like armed resistance, and that's what we need to be doing. So just thank you. It's just been a privilege to be on, have this discussion with you all.
All right. I'd like to give a shout out to the Tiny House Warriors and Kanahus and her crew and the other people who are fighting against the Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion. Shout out to the Six Nations people, Land Back campaign for just continuing on with the resistance and being an example of a warrior resistance. And a shout out to the Mi'kmaq still fighting to, you know, maintain their livelihood and also showing us that warrior spirit, and just keeping it on, through, you know, over the decades. Yeah, and shout out to all you guys, all of you people. It's important work that you're doing, and I just want to encourage everybody to keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah, right. I guess shout outs again to Tiny House Warriors, everybody out west, 1492 Landback Lane, the Mi'kmaq out east. I just want to also add my own community fighting against the Back 40 mine up on the border between Upper Michigan and Wisconsin, so-called. Organizationally, definitely, you good folks at Indigenous Action, you're always an incredible resource. All the stuff you guys make available in your zines and in your other publications, always something very curious to read or very informative. Also like to give a shout out to the folks at the Indigenous Anarchist Federation, who I've gotten to know relatively well in the last few months. They're good folks. Also, I guess a shout out to the Black Socialists of America, which is a group that I know the IAF right now is trying to build with, trying to build dual power networks, trying to think about how to think outside of these kind of internet communication platforms, because they can be suppressed at any moment with the kind of like techno know-how of the colonial state. Shout out to Anjanog and Sarnia against pipelines, who are the people leading that struggle that I said, and a lot of the other struggles against the Line 9 pipeline in Southern Ontario. And yeah, thanks for having me on. It's been great. It's been good to be able to talk to everybody.
Well, I feel like everyone's being shy about calling people out, but one thing I want to say is I kind of just want to give a big fuck you to all the artists and artisans who co-opt and misappropriate our struggles against police brutality and genocide and colonization and use it as a way to kind of like veil your liberal politics and use these messages by putting like fuck the police on earrings and selling it, and then actually just coming to find out that you like have a history of supporting your family in the military, or you don't actually believe in the abolition of the police. Y'all can fuck off and you can stop appropriating our messages and our struggle to make a profit. And I hope the people who are associated with that one particular so-called collective here in the Southwest are listening to this. And also, nobody cares about your stupid book signings. And then shout out to, honestly, I want to give a huge shout out to all of our Afro-Indigenous kin. I honestly can't imagine what it's like to be alive for you right now, being Black and Indigenous and having that probably lifelong confusion of trying to understand where it is that you are safe to operate in this fucking world. So much respect for your continued survival. And I want to be here right beside you in that struggle. And just much love to our Afro-Indigenous kin right now, especially.
Well, I guess my call out actually would be to warriors and the misconception of what that is. First and foremost, it's being present, but it isn't being present only in the moments in which some notion of glory or adventure or you being the, you know, the self-appointed savior is the only time you're present. In fact, more importantly, is actually your character above all. If your character is questionable, then it's less than everything you produce is going to be as tainted by that lack of character and the inability to learn from your mistakes by owning them, by dodging the accountability and responsibility in front of you. And more importantly, it's the idea of thinking beyond the moment, but being present in the moment. Because the more forward thinking we are about how we're going to engage in struggle. And it isn't my struggle or I struggle. It is a we struggle. And it's about putting everything else ahead of your own self-interests and selfish egotism or pride. And that's a good thing. It actually teaches you to a level of maturity, and it isn't something that's beyond the scope of understanding. Some of our most elevated heroes have many a mistake. Some have had flaws in character that they actually went out and corrected because they owned their behavior and they took responsibility and let themselves be held accountable for what they did, do, didn't do, or mistakenly did. That would be my call out. My shout out is actually to our wonderful guests right here who actually epitomize and inspire and a lot of what we've been talking about, and they've been cracking at it for years. like Gord himself, every time Gord starts going historical and analytic, I'm like, God damn it, we need another show. and then the contemporary moment we need as much as we can get. And Canahue's makes every single time that either she's speaking or doing something, I'm standing there, I'm going, it's ironic that she's calling out to the men, because I laugh and I go, maybe that they're not going out there because Canahue's is a high standard to try and meet, you know, and that's a good thing. Because I'd rather have people that can step up and be of caliber than people that are only going to be, you know, waifish and wander away and you know, blow away in the weeds when things get thick. And that's exactly what's going to happen. I want to thank Inamike for bringing his critical eye and critical mind to the present moment to kind of describe out and flesh out for the rest of us what it is that is on the horizon within this fascist paradigm that is slowly, not just slowly emerging, but has taken over the political space in occupied America, as it were. So thank you for being here on Indigenous Action. Thank you for offering your wisdom and your heart and your stories and, you know, adding some more fuel to our collective fire, and hopefully it spreads. And I hope the young people out there can see it too, about one, living with this kind of truth coming out and in your behavior and everything you have to say, and knowing exactly like what Canahue said, that this is a war posture. It isn't a question of whether or not you can participate. You're in participation whether you like it or not. We're people under siege and under direct occupation continent-wide and under constant assault. And so if we can actually come together enough to fight back and regain, not just defend what we have, all the better.
I wasn't going to do this, but I guess I'll say fuck you to the nonprofit industrial complex and all the capitalist exploiters who, as Bond mentioned, profit off of the struggles. And then just a shout out to young Indigenous folks who are finding their way through this, who are struggling, who see that voting is sacred bullshit propaganda from people who are pandering to the fucking liberal, neoliberal, neocolonial agendas. And shout out to those young folks who are navigating that, who understand that bullshit, and who are listening to this and becoming inspired to engage in militant, liberatory, anti-colonial struggle. So especially thank you. It's been an honor again talking with y'all, and hopefully we can have you back on the show.
You can find this broadcast on any of the usual podcast platforms or at www.indigenousaction.org. Email us pics of burning cop cars, any questions or topics you'd like to hear us go claws out on at iainfo@protonmail.com.
Fuel that fire so it's a blazing, blazing fire that they can never stop.